And I am so pleased to say that that program was brought to you live, live, live. So let's all howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is our 41st anniversary edition. I'm going to declare this and next week our 41st anniversary. And we're going to listen to an archive tape. An interview with the great Guy Gavriel Kay. Stay tuned. And good morning. Yes, as I said, also a landmark. I mean, not as big a landmark as being through that kind of nonsense. I did the opposite once. Before the surgery that was somehow magically mentioned on Robert's show on Earthwatch before, where there was no anesthesia, I had a radio show that very, very night. And I had been checked into the St. Vincent's Hospital, and they told me I was going to have surgery in the morning. And it's like, yeah, but you know what? I got to go home, feed the cats, and got to do a radio show, 5 to 7 a.m. And they thought, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, he's skipping. He's not going to get the surgery. And I went on the air, 5 a.m. I signed out against medical advice, AMA. and came into the station, opened these very microphones over, I guess it was 505 8th Avenue at the time, and just went on the air and said, I'm going to have surgery. Call up and tell me how awful this is. And so it was the opposite of, you know, being sick and coming in and all that. There was nothing like, you know, if you didn't have something good to say, something soothing, callers were off the air, you know. But if you were there to pat my head, okay, and say, there, Jim, then it was a cool call. Well, there, Robert, and hoorah for WBAI, which is what you are tuned to, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. So, 41st anniversary show. Hour of the Wolf began in January of 1972. I don't remember the exact date. All I, you know, at some point I did an archaeological dig through old WBAI folios and what follows as sort of memory for me. And I found, yes, that was 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 a.m. It was easily found because before that, WBAI was not a 24-hour-a-day radio station. And Margot Adler had made a deal, which I'm not going to go into the entire thing, with the station manager at the time, who I think was Jerry Coffin, and created the 5 to 7 a.m. slot. And all I know is that this was January of 1972. I began doing the show about two and a half years later. I was her engineer pretty much 5 days a week, or at least gopher, if I wasn't actually engineering the show, and the one to remind her, Margo, you left your keys in master again. And on Thursdays and Fridays, she and I co-hosted. She invited me to co-host for what was the science fiction extravaganza. After I took over the show, I did it 5 days a week for a few years, then 2 days a week, sort of farming out the other 3 days. And then in 1980, 81, thereabouts, program director Steve Erickson bumped me into Saturday mornings 5 to 7. And 2 years ago, Tony Bates and Berthold Reimers more or less canceled the show, but worked out this time slot. In fact, very, very, very much thanks to Robert Knight for giving up a half hour of his so that I could be here. So, but dating the show back, dating Hour of the Wolf back to 1971, not knowing the date, nevertheless, I declare this week and next week 41st anniversary shows. So there. But like last week, when I played you a recording with the amazing Karen Lord, we have another fine, fascinating writer to listen to this morning. And this is a recording from 2007 with Guy Gavriel Kay. He is a writer primarily of dark fantasy. Not all of it is dark. But at the time of this recording, his novel Isabeau with a Y-S, let me see if I can find it in print here so I don't screw it up. Y-S-A-B-E-L is my recollection. Isabel. Yep, I found it. Isabel. Who is a goddess, demoness kind of character. It takes place in the countryside in France. Amazing novel. Most of his novels are absolutely amazing. He writes a modern urban fantasy that harkens back, way back, to early times. And this novel is an example of it, and we're going to listen to an interview with him as well as a reading that he performed for us. So, hope it's not totally edited. You know, we didn't get every little bit out, but we did, however, manage to, be on topic from the beginning. So you'll hear a couple of off-mic comments and stuff like that, but you'll hear the entirety of the interview. And I trust you will enjoy it. Here's Guy Gavriel Kay and me. I am in on part of what they call Little Brazil. That is to say, 46th Street in Manhattan. It is April 12th, 2007. And I'm here with Guy Gavriel Kay, who is just a wonderful writer of mostly fantasy, some would say historical fantasy. Mm-hmm. Although his latest novel, I would say Isabel, how would you pronounce it?
Isabel's Pond, that's what I've been calling it.
Yeah, Isabel, is set in contemporary times, but is reliant on history.
Isabel's the first time, Jim, and this wasn't my observation, it was a clever reviewer, and there are a few of those, who made the observation that this is the first time I've been able to write about history instead of inside a historical period. Mm-hmm. By setting it as a contemporary book where figures from mythic historical past of Provence, the south of France, enter the lives of contemporary figures, I'm able to use that kind of framework to comment on aspects of the past. The previous five or six books were all set in fantasy analogs of historical periods, so we are embedded in those settings. I can't make observations about contemporary attitudes to the past. I'm encased in the past, and in that sense, Isabel is a departure.
And it's not just a departure to modern times, but you seem almost ensconced in it, the way that you have incorporated things that people younger than you and I, such as ringtones and all the little things that probably even today a lot of young adults might not have considered. You may have endangered some of us with the kind of pranks that can be played. You've gotten right into the head of the 21st century teenager.
Well, you know what, Jim? It's interesting. This is, first of all, thank you. And it interests me because a number of responses to the book have focused on the fact that the protagonist is a teenage male, and there's a teenage woman involved, as well as many older figures. What I find interesting about it is when people will say something on the order of Kay has nailed the modern adolescent, or some people will say Kay's adolescent doesn't quite work for me because it's not the teenager that I know. Mm-hmm. What I find interesting about this is the idea that it should be harder to get a contemporary teenager than, say, a 65-year-old widow, or an emperor, or a prostitute in a quasi-medieval setting. What I find intriguing is how readers are focusing on this as noteworthy. From my point of view, in most respects, you need less research to do a contemporary teenager than you do to try to realistically or convincingly portray a 6th century Byzantine emperor. Mm-hmm. But people are intrigued by the teenager, and I think it's because we all feel capable of being critics. We all know contemporary 15-year-olds, and so we measure such a figure in a book against the ones we know. Mm-hmm. More of us are likely to cut an author slack when they're doing an equivalent of Shalmag or something like that, because we'll say, well, I wouldn't know, so I'll assume they did their homework. But in fact, Ned Mariner, the teenage protagonist of Isabel, was in many significant ways not as hard a stretch for me, mm-hmm, in trying to embody and realize a central figure as many of the other characters that I've created over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. How about photographer?
Same thing. Contemporary photographer, adult with an adolescent son, It's a slam dunk, mm-hmm. or it should be. Now, having said that, I don't want to be flippant about it because it's always difficult creating characters that readers will care about. Right. It's what, if I can put it this way, it's what most books miss out on.
Mm-hmm.
We miss out on the character identification.
Especially in fantastic genre.
I think there's an element of that. What I've said, though, it's not only in fantasy and science fiction. What I've said for years is that a good book will have interesting things happening to interesting people. Now, you need both of those. A lot of really compelling genre fiction or thrillers, Da Vinci Code kinds of books will have quote-unquote interesting things happening. The narrative drive is there. The plot is energized. There is an idea behind the story science fiction has always prided itself on having. But the people are dull as dishwater,
mm-hmm.
or flat as cardboard. On the other hand, many of the most honored and renowned so-called mainstream fiction novels will have carefully realized, closely observed protagonists to whom nothing of the slightest interest happens. And I've always made the point that it's not a zero-sum game. It's
That's
not
right.
either or.
What has always drawn me into your books is first the protagonist. And the fact that I feel that I am along with that person and enjoying that person, liking that person. This is somebody who I would probably want to hang out with and be friends with.
You know, there's a line Quentin Tarantino once said that his favorite movie was Rio Bravo.
Mm.
The Howard Hawks Western.
Written by Lee Brackett.
Yep, that's right. John Wayne, Dean Martin. And his explanation for why was that he said exactly what you just said. He said, I watch it almost every week because I like hanging out with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an element of that that I think is significant in our response to fiction. I actually think it's part of what the success of the huge ongoing multi-volume fantasy sagas. For years, Jim, I tried to figure out, because I don't write them, and they don't draw me. And I was trying to get a sense of what the hook was for so many readers.
Mm-hmm.
And Tarantino gave me my insight into this. The hook is the same as the kind of appeal that something like General Hospital or Days of Our Lives, the soap operas, would have.
Mm-hmm.
We like hanging out with the characters in that soap opera or with the characters in that 5, 6, 10-volume fantasy. When you add for fantasy that it's not just the characters we're hanging out with, it's the world we're hanging out in. That, I think, is what readers keep coming back for, even if they're complaining that the narrative hasn't moved anywhere for the last 3 volumes. They'll keep coming back because they're hanging out.
Well, you do a fascinating thing in Isabel, which only really just occurred to me as I was thinking about it, is that you were talking about soaps, and I have unfortunately been subjected to watching some soaps recently.
Better you than me, Jim.
Oh, God. And the daytime television fare is so horrifying. And the reason for that is that I couldn't find one character that I would want to, that I wouldn't cross the street to get away from. the people are abhorrent. They are nasty, mean people, and small-minded, and the situations are more fantastic than anything you've ever written, even though they're not mm-hmm. moving into the genre realms. And there's always truly evil, bad events and bad guys. And one of the remarkable things in Isabel is, now that I think about it, there isn't a bad guy in there.
I'm bored.
There's not one.
I'm bored, and I have been for a long time as a reader and as a writer, by overly stated black and white in characterization, in plotting. I'm interested as a reader and as a writer and as a film goer by shadings, by work that attempts to capture some of what really does surround us, which is complexity and shading of human behavior. And as a writer, I'm trying to go for that. So yes, there's no villain in Isabel.
There's no villain, and there's never not jeopardy. There's rarely not jeopardy and situations and all that, but the most, the darkest of the characters in there are people that you wouldn't mind having a meal with.
They're dangerous, but they're not evil.
That's correct.
And there's an enormous difference between the two that I'm trying to negotiate that difference.
And that was one of the things that I loved about it. And I also liked the fact that there are certain things, let us call it the Buffy syndrome. How many years can we go before Buffy's mother figures something out? Okay, and that was something, I love Buffy, I thought it was a trend breaker and broke molds and did a lot of stuff. But even there, and even though I knew that I was watching television fair, I simply took it for granted that, well, okay, we're talking about, for example, a TV mom here.
Right.
And
the rules of the game.
Exactly.
We cut some slack because it's being played out in a certain kind of artificial environment, and so we don't ask certain kinds of questions. A novelist has to deal with that.
Let's rephrase that. A good novelist has to deal with that.
Okay. Or a novelist should try to deal with
Thank you.
One of the... and I spent a lot of time trying to sort out aspects of what you're talking about. And there are two different things bundled in your observation, Jim. One is a dislike I have, and I suspect you will share it, for books where you're too much smarter than the protagonist, where you figure something out 100 pages before the allegedly intelligent protagonist does, there's a kind of feeling of superiority you get to the fictional character that's not a pleasant one because you're impatient with them.
Yeah.
So I've been accused at times of having characters that are too damn smart, that they're quicker than ordinary people would be. I can live with that. I would rather live with that accusation, if you will, than the flip side, which is that the characters are dull and boring and they're way too slow on the uptick. I would rather have quick characters than slow ones.
Yeah.
And this is my taste as a reader. We all write the kinds of books that we would like to read if somebody else wrote them. I really believe that. The other part of your point, which has to do with the surrounding people and their attitudes.
Precisely.
There's that great cliche of the horror movie where the kid who's seen the aliens and the mutant spiders and nobody believes him because he's just a kid, or the town drunk. You know, town drunks have a monopoly on first sightings.
Right.
It's always going to be the town drunk so that nobody will believe him.
Yeah. And then in bad writing, it will often be somebody who is fully credible and people still won't believe that person.
And I would rather go the other way. I would rather treat my characters as capable of picking something up on the balance, if you will. They may not grab it instantly. They may not believe elements of the supernatural in Isabel, nor should they, because you lose credibility that way, too.
Yes.
You know, if you come back and say, I just saw a 16-headed, green-eyed monster on the ridge behind the house, somebody says, oh, that's interesting, did you take a picture for the magazine? That's a bit stupid as well.
Yeah.
One of the things I did in Isabel was displace the characters before the story begins. And let me explain what I mean by that. They are Canadians and Americans. They're in the south of France, in a house on the edge of a small city. They're in the wilderness, really. They're in the countryside. They're off home turf. They're not where they belong. They've already made a journey, if you will, away from a comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
When you're off home turf, a lot of things happen to you psychologically. And some are good, some are destabilizing. But one of the things that happens is that you don't operate by the same rules you do when you're where you live, mm-hmm. when you're on your own ground. So if somebody disappears...
And also, another element to that is that the entire family is not together at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That,
and they need to reassemble,
to
which
That's
is the
right.
theme of the book, the
yes.
need for the family to reassemble, to come to terms with your own past as well as the larger historical past.
So it adds to that removal mm-hmm. of yes. the norm. So
but I was thinking about this question, that how do you deal with... supernatural encounters or mythic visitations. If you're at home, you may call the cops.
Mm-hmm.
You might rally your friends or something like that. You, there are certain courses of action you'll follow because you're in your space. If you are across the ocean, in the countryside, in a foreign country, the range of responses you have changes. And for me, that was one of the things that sets up the plot in Isabel, because everyone is off their base. Everyone is already away from the normal space before even more unusual, non-normal things start happening in the story.
Mm-hmm. So, one of the things that I enjoyed sort of works in, for me in acts. And there was a point where we're introduced to one character, to Ned and his surroundings. And just at the point, at the end of part one, where I was going to go, okay, well, now we're going to get into the disbelief, which does not happen. And the next generation or other characters don't necessarily trust in what they're being told, but they trust in our lead character.
They say, trust that something's happening.
They trust that something's happening, that this is that he's not going. I was pulled right back in, where anything else would have taken a left turn. This kept me, or a right turn.
Because the book didn't do what you were resigned to the book doing.
Yes,
you would
exactly.
talk yourself
yes,
ready to say, okay,
right.
I know what the next step in all of these stories is.
And for me, it was like a rediscovery of the book as I was enjoying it, and at a point where in another book, my interest might have begun to flag. I re-enjoyed it. I was re...
It's interesting that you're saying this, Jim, and I'm getting this from you as a long-time reader of the genre and very versed in the... cliches as well as the change that can be run. Roger Turner,
mm-hmm.
who's the editor of the sfsite.com and one of the coordinators for World Fantasy Convention, was good enough to tell me a few months ago when I was in Ottawa working there, I was doing a reading, and Roger and I had a drink before, and he said that Isabel had restored a lot of his belief and faith in fantasy fiction.
Yes.
Which had been flagging for him for the last 10 or 15 years. And Roger said, and you tell me if this has happened to you, Roger was blaming himself. Roger was saying, I'm getting old, I'm getting cranky, I'm not with it anymore, I'm tired, and maybe it's me, not the writers. Maybe the books are as good as they ever were, and I'm losing it. And his comment was that after reading Isabel, he stepped back and said, I'm not losing it. I can still recognize when something really works for me and in the genre.
Yes.
And he actually moved me very deeply, Jim.
Yeah. And well, he should have, but no, I don't agree with his original premise. I think it is the writers, largely. I think that... and it may not be their
or
fault.
The culture.
It's the market.
It's the culture
and the market.
Well, the same thing,
well,
really.
Yeah, although I wonder which
one... The market
one...
feeds the culture. Publishers will give us what we've told them we want, and if we tell them we want the Da Vinci Code,
yeah,
that's what they're going to give us.
Yeah.
If we
although
tell
I think
them we want 8 other books on the Templars, that's what they're going to give us.
I think there's a certain chicken or egg kind of thing there, because they will tell us that, and they will sell that, and they will market that. But, you know, Tolkien is around for how many years before first the college students in the 60s discovered? Then before there was a psychedelic rediscovery.
That's the 60s, too. You're right.
Yeah.
Go-Go Gandalf and...
Yeah, exactly. Frodo Lives and all that. But then there's also the... Well, it was threatened by the Ralph Bakshi generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a bad script by Peter S. Beagle, certainly a good writer on the first movie. Everybody has thankfully forgotten that film. And then it lay fallow in the 80s, except for so many bad clones, that all fantasy was derivative either of Tolkien or of Robert E. Howard, or I'm trying to think who would be the precursor for Piers Anthony.
Is there one?
The Andrew Lang, I guess.
You know, there's a... we're on ground that has been with us for a while, these issues. That's a mixed metaphor. But one issue that we've been wrestling with one way or another within fantasy for a long time. And part of what's involved here is a kind of defensiveness within the fantasy genre that I don't think needs to be there. And let me tell you what to say. Every form of art, from painting to music to sport to cooking to writing, the mediocre will vastly outnumber the excellent.
Yes.
This is Sturgeon's law with a vengeance, that the idea that 80 or 90% of everything is crud is a truth that runs right across the sphere of human endeavor. Most doctors are mediocre.
Yes.
Most drivers are mediocre. What happens sometimes in fantasy or science fiction, because there's an element of defensiveness that can creep in, that people worry about it as if it's unique to the form. Most mainstream fiction is very bad. Most rock music is very bad. We value excellence specifically because it's so rare.
Yet
the rarity that gives it that charge for us of wonder. And so, while I would not disagree with you, the analysis you just offered about the cloning and the shabby imitations or the mediocre work that dominated, it still dominates.
Oh, yes.
Fantasy. I would say they dominate every form of art and endeavor. Fantasy doesn't need to be particularly defensive about that aspect any more than any other kind of art form does. When I was younger, I was more of a crusader. I wrote the Fiona Bau Tapestry in the 80s, partly as a gauntlet thrown down, if you will, to all of the books that were coming out using Tolkien as a prime resource.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, go back to where Tolkien went.
Exactly. I mean, Tolkien was...
Go back to the prime source.
Was really writing one of the great resources. That's
exactly
what he was doing.
Right.
That was the whole reason he did that, that and philology.
Yeah. Philology for him was the unique starting point, but all the other elements
coming
were
from the upper Edda,
what he drew upon for his story.
Yeah.
And I wrote Fiona Bau as a kind of young man's crusading attempt to say that you can work with all of the variables that The Lord of the Rings used. You can even make it a three-volume book. And I did Fiona Bau deliberately as a trilogy. Now trilogies are short. But back then, that was the defining form of fantasy.
I prefer the term three-volume book, which was Tolkien's intent. Mm-hmm. He never intended to write a trilogy.
Oh, it was a single book?
Yeah. Absolutely.
It was a book. It was
a
paper shortage.
Yeah.
The paper shortage. It was going to be too massive a book.
Yeah.
And then it became a template for everything that followed.
That's right.
So I did that in Fiona Bau. When I wrote it, I actually sat down and I said, how am I going to deal with the single biggest problem of all trilogies, which is what I've been calling for 20 years, the mid-book problem. Is that the second book doesn't have the energy of a beginning, and it doesn't have the energy of a resolution and a conclusion.
Yeah.
It's in the middle, so you have to come up with some literary device, some literary plot, character, elements that give it impetus at the start and a sense of closure at the end, which, by the way, The Lord of the Rings doesn't have because it wasn't meant to be a trilogy.
Right.
But I sat down and I said, how can I do in The Wandering Fire? What can I do? And I'm not going to say what I did. The readers who've read the trilogy will remember, and those who will go find it will spot it.
And have a treat in front of them, yes. In that sense, you have not really written sequels or anything. You've written multi-volume books. Have you ever considered the concept of a sequel or revisiting a world?
I've considered an amazing number of things, Jim. Some of them are even legal. the truth is that I never know what the next book will be when I finish one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't plan in large, overarching ways a kind of tying together my body of work.
Mm-hmm.
I did revisit a world, I'm putting scatter quotes around that, when I wrote Lions of Arwasan and I went on to do the Sarantine Mosaic. Lions is based on 11th, 12th century Spain before the Reconquest, Christians, Jews, Moors in the Spanish Peninsula in a fantasy setting. And when I came to do Sailing to Sarantium, I was trying to capture the Byzantine Empire in its most decadent, glamorous period, the 6th century of Justinian and Theodora. And I knew my protagonist would have to be a mosaicist. I knew that because everything I read about the period seemed to come back to the mosaic art that they worked with. And I remember...
That was one of the things that I loved about that book so much, was it just drew
That was our first conversation, that. Wasn't it? A long way back, with our online interaction.
It was an online conversation about that, as the book was coming out, as I recall. And and the funny thing is, I had gone to museums, I had seen classic mosaics, I had... And I had even, as a kid, done...
little mosaic kits.
Yeah, I had those little kits, you know, where you just put the tiles in place and you add the glue or whatever. And I can, as we're talking about it now, the scent is coming back to me. That was
now they'll do it online.
Scent.
You don't have to get glue on your fingers.
That's right. But it had never really occurred to me, even looking at some of the great art and architecture, just what this was in terms of a profession.
Yeah.
And I got the sense of a mosaicist, did you say? Is that a proper pronunciation of mosaicist? As one might get of that being a photographer in Isabel.
Well, they're the direct good for you in the sense that there's some pleasures, I hope, that readers of many of my books will get from the dialogue between one book and the other. And Edward Mariner in Isabel is in conversation, if you will, with Crispin of the Sarantine Mosaic. They are both men no longer young. They both travel from the West to the East.
Mm-hmm.
They are both artists who work in an art form built around light. Because that's what mosaic is. And in the Sarantine Mosaic, the pair of books, I talk about that it's an art form built around light, and of course, what else is photography?
Mm-hmm.
But to go back to the point that we were on, when I knew that it would be a mosaicist protagonist, and thinking about an art form built around light, I reminded myself that in Lions of Arwasan, the book I just finished, I had a sun god. I had a religious use of the Roman idea of Mithras, the religion of the god of the sun, I had a sun god. And I sort of did the equivalent of smacking myself upside the head and saying, you're an idiot if you don't stay with this religion. Sun god religion, because what kind of art would be the most exalted, the holiest in a culture that exalts light in the way that they do.
That gives a whole new meaning to light reading.
Of course. And that's why the mosaic stayed in the same world as Lines of Our Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I did Last Light of the Sun, which was my Vikings, Anglo-Saxons, Celts book, I stayed again in the same world. Hundreds of years have passed. We're in completely different geographic space. One is Spain, one is Byzantium, the other is the British Isles and Scandinavia. But I stayed with the two moons and the religion of the God of Light. Remember the title, Last Light of the Sun.
Right.
I'm working off that idea of a part of the world in Last Light that is removed at the edges and the margins of the world. These are people in that book who are working so hard to stay alive that the idea of mosaic art or sumptuous feasts or chariot racing, as in the Sarantine books, or gardens of exquisite beauty, as in Lions of Our Sun, they don't even enter the event horizon. You're trying to stay alive. And I set that book as a deliberate commentary. This is that dialogue again.
Mm-hmm.
A commentary on the previous three novels that had all been about extremely sophisticated, decadent, worldly environments. This is a harder northern one in Last Light of the Sun. So you're right, if you were to say a photographer and a mosaicist, I'm doing that all the time.
Yeah.
Because when I write a book, I think, okay, I have an interesting angle on a given topic, but there are other angles. And in a later book, I can look at that same theme with characters who offer that other angle.
I mean, this is a great point for us to take a break, and then you will read for us.
Sure.
Okay.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We are in mid-January of the year 13, as Simon Locley says, the year 2013. And this is a 41st anniversary edition of Hour of the Wolf. We are listening to an interview with fantasy novelist Guy Gavriel Kaye. And we will now go to part two of that interview, in which he will read for us. And by the way, this was recorded in 2007.
Short preamble, backgrounder. Okay. Whenever I read, I have a couple of mantras for myself. One is I hate spoilers, so I hate when authors give away major elements of the plot in a reading. And the other is I hate the need for really long, extensive background explanation of who everybody is. So this bit from Isabel comes quite early in the book. Isabel takes place in the south of France today, in and around the city of Aix-en-Provence near Marseille. The protagonist, Ned Mariner, is in a cathedral one morning while his father, a photographer, is taking pictures for a coffee table book. And inside the cathedral, he encounters a young girl named Kate from New York, who shouldn't be there, and because it's closed off. And then the two of them encounter someone who not only shouldn't be there, shouldn't be now. And that encounter gives rise to the scene I'm going to read, which takes place the next day when Ned and Kate have met for a coffee to discuss what happened in the cathedral. And the scene will shift very quickly to the point of view of the figure that they met the day before. And it's one of those small parting the curtain things I've been doing on this book tour over the last couple of months for readers. Whenever Isabel, the book, shifts into the point of view of one of the three
mythic historical characters who drive the narrative. That voice is done in the present tense. The novel switches to present tense whenever that happens. Because I wanted to use that to show how intensely these people exist in the present time when they're here. And the present tense was my method of doing that. You'll catch it as soon as I get going. That reminds me, Keith said. You asked about the Celts, where they were around here. And of course you found out. Google is your friend. Google is my midnight lover. I'm not sure I'm ready to hear that, actually, she laughed. The Celts were all over the area. There's one place I've seen we can walk to if you want. The waiter came by and they paid for their drinks. Might as well, Ned said. She nodded. Day after tomorrow, Thursday, meet after school, say, outside Cezanne's studio. Can you find it? I'll find it. Where are we going? It's called Entremont, where the Celts were based before the Romans built this city. Okay. I'll be outside that studio at 5. I'll call you tomorrow. Cool. She got up, stuffed the notepad in her pack. They walked out together. On the street, he turned to her. Thanks, Kate. She made a face. Okay, you're welcome. Call me. She gave him a little flip wave with one hand, then turned and walked along the cobblestones. He watched her go. Inside the cafe, the man in the gray and leather jacket, two tables over from where they'd been, puts down his newspaper. There's no need to hide his face anymore. He might have learned something here, he is thinking. A thread, a way into the labyrinth. This is a possibility, no more than that, but it is that. When you were in urgent need and time was very short and your enemy had most of the weapons, you used tools like these two children. In one way, it is obvious. In another, the girl is right. There are too many choices here, and from where he is, he has no easy way to narrow them down. There are still too many places. That hasn't changed. But he's decided something sitting here, and these two are at the heart of it. The boy, from the start. From before the cathedral, since he's being truthful, and he always is with himself. He isn't certain about the girl. He'd waited and watched them from a distance yesterday after leaving the cloister, saw them walk here, made an assumption they'd be back. If he'd been wrong, if they had met elsewhere, not after school or not at all, he wouldn't have been unduly disturbed. Few things affect him that much anymore. When he's in the world again, when he returns, his is an entirely focused existence. He is only ever alive for one thing. Well, two, really. At the same time, he wasn't surprised when they did show up, nor by what he heard the girls say from behind the screening pages of his newspaper. They have no business going where they're going 2 days from now. But he might. He might have many lives worth of business there. Or not. He might lose this time before it even begins. It has happened. It is unfair, an unbalanced aspect of the combat. But he's long since moved beyond thinking that way. What is fairness in this dance? His sitting here is, in the end, just a feeble reaching out for signs from two children who have nothing to do with the tale. At the same time, he's learned, things fall into patterns. You can miss patterns or break them, but they're there. He finds a few coins, drops them on the table, rises to go. Why didn't I know you were here? He looks up. His way out is blocked. He is actually startled. The sensation is strange, a lost feeling remembered. For no easy reason, he suddenly has an image of his first time here, walking through the forest from the landing place, invited but uncertain, afraid, so far from home. He sits down again, he gestures. The boy is standing between the table and the door. He sits gingerly opposite, edge of chair, as if ready to bolt. The newspaper lies on the table between them, folded back. He'd been reading the forecast. Wind, clear skies. There will be a full moon Thursday. He'd known that, of course. The boy has spoken in English. The man says gravely in the same language, "You've surprised me again. Brave of you to come back. I take it you sent the girl away." Ned Mariner shrugs. He has dark brown hair, light blue eyes, a lean build, medium height, wiry rather than strong, barely old enough to shave. His face is pale. He will be dealing with tension and fear. "Welcome to my world," the man thinks, but doesn't say. He doesn't feel welcoming. "No, she just went. I don't send her places. I don't know anything. I didn't know anything until I was outside. And besides, I'm the one feeling whatever this is. If you're dangerous, there's no reason for her to be here." "Dangerous?" He smiles at that. "You have no idea. I said I wouldn't kill you, but there are others who might view your presence differently." "I know I have no idea, but what does my presence mean? My presence where?" He stops to control himself. His voice has risen. "And why didn't I know you were here till I got outside?" That last, he decides to answer. "I was careless. I was screening myself from you after yesterday in the cloister, but I thought you'd gone, so I let it down. I had gone. I don't even know why I checked inside. I was halfway across the market square." He considers that. "Then you are stronger than you knew." "I don't know anything," the boy says again. His voice is lower now, intense. "There was someone like this long ago. A vague sense tugs at him. But there are too many years between. He's been here so many times." Ned Mariner leans back, folding his arms defensively across his chest. "I have no idea who you are or what happened to me yesterday or today, if you heard us talking about that," he nods. "So what is this about?" the boy demands. He really shouldn't be using that tone. "You said we were an accident, had no role to play, but you followed or waited for us." He's clever, it seems. "Followed yesterday, waited just now. I took a chance you'd come back." "But why?" The waiter is hovering. He signals for another of what each of them was drinking. A mild curiosity rises. "You don't feel reckless interrogating me like this? Scared out of my mind if you want the truth." "But that isn't the truth," he says. "Who did this one remind him of? You came back by choice. You're demanding answers of me. And yet you know I sculpted a column 800 years ago. No, you're frightened but not ruled by it." "Probably should be," the boy says in a small voice. "It isn't a column either. It's a woman." The quick, familiar anger, a sense of intrusion, violation, rude feet trampling in something private beyond words. He makes himself move past it. By today's standards, this one is young, can still properly be called a boy. In the past, he could have been a war leader fit for challenging, killing. He has killed children. The world has changed. He has lived through the changes at intervals, coming and going enmeshed in the long pattern. Sometimes he wants it over. Mostly he's terrified, heart scalded, that it might end. You could grow weary beyond measure, feeling all those things at once. The waiter comes back, an espresso and orange juice, the brisk habitual motions. He waits until the man leaves. He says, still speaking English for privacy, "Once this awareness comes to you, it can be a kind of anchor against fear. You know what you are feeling, know a new thing is in you. The fear lies in not understanding why. But already you're not the person you were yesterday morning." He sips his espresso, puts the cup down, adds quietly, "You never will be again." A cruel thing to say, perhaps. He isn't beyond enjoying that. That's scary, too. I imagine it is. He finishes his coffee. "Frightened or not, you came back. You could have kept walking. You're inside now." "Then you need to tell me what I'm inside." "I need to do nothing." Use words more cautiously. "Or what?" Opposing anger across the table. Interestingly, he really isn't accustomed to talking this much anymore. "Or what?" the boy demands again. "You'll stab me in here, pull a knife?" He shakes his head. "Or I'll walk out." Ned Mariner hesitates again, then leans forward. "No, you won't. You don't want to leave me. You want me in this somehow. What did we say, Kate and me, that you needed to hear?" Someone else had once talked to him this way. That nagging memory still there. Was it centuries ago or a millennium? He isn't sure. People blur after so much time. Then he looks across the table and realizes he was wrong. This impudent tone isn't the same as the other long-ago voice. With a degree of surprise, he sees that the boy is close to tears, fighting to hide it. He tries, unsuccessfully, to remember when he felt that way himself. Too far back. This defiant anger is a boy's in the end. Anger at helplessness, at being ignorant and young, not yet an adult, and so immune. Boys believed adults were immune to the pain he's feeling. Had he been a different man, he might have addressed some of this. Ned Mariner has, after all, come to the edges of the tale, and he might even be an instrument. But that is all he can be. You didn't confide in tools or comfort them. You made use of what lay to hand. He stands up, drops a few coins on the table. "I don't know if you said anything I need. It is too long to tell, and I'm disinclined to do so. You are better off not knowing, though it may not seem that way to you. You will have to forgive me or not, as you like." Then he adds, "Perhaps a mistake," it occurs to him, even as he speaks. "I wouldn't go up to Entremont on the eve of Beltane, though." The youthful gaze is sharp suddenly. "That was it, wasn't it?" Ned Mariner says. He doesn't look any more as if he might cry. "What Kate said about that place." The man doesn't respond. He really isn't accustomed to answering questions. Never has been, if truth were told, even from when he entered the tale himself, having come across the sea. Everyone here has come from somewhere else. He'd said that to her once. He remembers her reply. He remembers everything she had ever said to him, it sometimes feels. He walks to the cafe door and out into the late April afternoon. The dogs have been waiting, scuffling around the market nearby. They attack as soon as he reaches the street.
We knew the title because of Ingmar Bergman.
Right.
Because of the movie.
That's cool.
Which is an interesting movie. I wouldn't call it Bergman's best.
Yeah, but I wonder how many 20-somethings will ever... Do you know that we can't even watch? People can't see Seventh Seal anymore. Because, and this is another, it's an extension of what we were just saying. There have been so many parodies of the Seventh Seal. Not just imitations, but parodies. And we're so culturally couped in certain ways. We've seen satire and parody. That when a knight sits down to play chess with death, you can't watch it without remembering Woody Allen.
Exactly.
Having a guy play Gin Rummy with death. Or Ledova, the Swedish parody with the badminton with death.
Yes, I love that.
You know, we can't see the original anymore because too many things have come in between. That's happened to Tolkien.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's happened.
Very much.
I'll never forget the first time online. Are we rolling or are we running
to... I just started rolling, in fact, when I reached over there because
I'll never forget
the conversation was too
good. Sure. I'll never forget the first time that I read an online discussion where somebody says, I'm reading Robert Jordan and he rules, and I've heard a bit about this guy Tolkien. Is he any good?
Oh, my.
Well, but it's not a... stupid question.
No, it's not a stupid question, but it's one that Robert Jordan would react very badly to.
I think, of course, but it's the culture works backwards. The culture works in flips. I've had people ask me if Fionnabar was influenced by certain books that were written 15 years after it.
Right.
And then I end up having to say, well, you might want to ask the same question, but turn it the other way around.
Yes. Very much so.
And that ties in with one of my own major themes, which is the degree to which we're not aware of history today. You know, Santayana's great quote about those who cannot remember the past
are condemned to repeat it.
There is a, like all great quotes, it sounds too glib, but it's also carries within it a profound truth, which is that if we don't know what we've come from, we have less ability to shape where we're going and avoid the mistakes that operate as patterns or templates for what we're doing. And you can make the case that the last half dozen novels I've written, including Isabel, are all variations on this theme. In Isabel, what I was trying to do, Jim, was write a book about characters today confronting the reality of Celts and Greeks and Romans and their first collision, which took place in Provence in the south of France. It was the first Roman province. That's how it got its name. And that's the macro idea of the past, the collision of two worldviews, the Celtic worldview and the Roman-Greek worldview. But the novel also runs forward on the idea of one family. We've been talking about Ned Mariner and his father and his mother, who is a physician with Doctors Without Borders, enters the story partway through. She joins them. Within the family unit, we talk about the past and history as well. The feud between our grandfather and his brother, that's the reasons why our cousins never spoke to each other. The fight between our mother and her sister that still ripples or resonates through our family. We use history that way. We even use it personally. I used to be in love with her, but that's history.
Right.
We talk that way, and our personal history is obviously as important for us as the larger history of the culture, country, world we live in. And in Isabel, I tried to run the story forward on both those train tracks. The large history of that part of the world, which can only be dealt with if the family sorts out its own personal history within itself.
At the same time.
At the same time. You're working on both simultaneously.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned that there's more to the family than the immediate nuclear family, which is, for me, one of the great joys of those other characters. That come into it in Act Two. as it were.
Yeah.
How do you research? Your books are just one step off center of historical novels. And I feel I have rarely traveled outside of New York in my life, and I feel I know a little something about Provence.
That's great.
And how do you research? How have you brought me to those places?
Well, this was a little bit different. Charles Brown of Locust said that the French Tourist Board should be giving me a kickback for Isabel because of the tourist element to it. Generally, for the historical fantasies, it has been very deeply embedded in reading as much as I can get my hands on about a given time and place, traveling there and taking notes when I can. The key for me about the relationship between research and a novel is that you must never give in to the temptation of telling everything you know. That's where you get the info dump process. That's where you get what I've been calling, and forgive me for taking his name in vain, the James Michener School of Fiction. And Michener, incidentally, Michener as a young man was a terrific novelist. Tales of the South Pacific, which won the Pulitzer Prize, was a great collection of stories that gave rise to South Pacific the Musical. Later in life, he found a formula that the market, we've been talking about the
Hawaii
market and the public. Exactly. And after Hawaii, when he got to Chesapeake, Alaska, Texas, all of these books, where by then he had a research team working for him. He had a stable of researchers doing the research. These books served an interesting function for a lot of readers. People who might have felt guilty reading a historical novel assuaged their guilt by saying, I'm learning something. This is a very American phenomenon, especially among men. As you know, 3/4 of fiction is read by women. Men often feel guilty about reading novels. They read political biographies or some such thing. Michener's books allowed people to feel happy with themselves because they were learning stuff. But as fiction, as novels, those info dumps stop the book cold. I will now tell you tons of stuff about Texas, and the narrative is brought up short. I've always tried to slip in the research as it is required by the dictates of the novel, of the story shape, what you need to know.
Yeah.
I know enough to bore you for the next hour about Byzantine chariot racing, and I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
In Isabel, it was different because we were living there. I wrote the book in that part of the world. We went there for a year. And I went over. I would like to say, Jim, that I'm smart enough to have gone to the south of France because I was going to write a book about the south of France.
Right.
I'm not that good. I went over there. We put our kids in school, and we settled in. And I was going to figure out what the next book would be. And I had a trunk full of books covering a wide cross-section of periods and places. And Jim, in that part of the world, in the area around Aix-en-Provence, Arles, Avignon, you can't take 10 steps without stubbing your toe on history.
Yeah.
And after a very little while, I sort of did that usual smack myself on the side of the head I do so often, and I said, don't be an idiot. You're fighting the obvious. There's a book to be told here, and with contemporary people going through this process of colliding
with that history.
And
one of the things that I love about the book is that it brings you into the discovery process. I had never thought that much about the life of a coffee table book photographer. It never occurred to me that this person would have an entourage of researchers and assistant what would be involved.
James Michener.
Exactly. And although would he travel with an entourage? He's
at the highest levels, when you're talking major books, when you're talking the really established photographers, think of a fashion shoot.
Well, on the photographer,
think of how many people are involved on a Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
Yeah.
that's not just the Field Photographer as a model. That is a battalion.
It's a production crew. Yeah, absolutely.
So in this case, we've got three people.
But in the case of, you know, an Eisenstadt or somebody like that, and what that allows for is not only the insight into a profession that many people would, of course, love to have, the fantasy of being able to travel around the world and be either a photographer or, if you will, perhaps a fantasy novelist, there is also to that the attraction of the process of discovery, that as the characters discover Aix-en-Provence, as they discover the world, the history around it, so do we. We are vicariously part of that process.
It's really interesting because I'm often asked if I outline the books, and I don't. And then I quickly add, but I know a lot of writer friends of mine who outline everything before they write word one. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I don't, I try to make the point, it's often writers who are asking me this, young writers. And I'm saying, don't take any prescription from what I'm telling you. I'm not suggesting that this is how you should do it. But I do believe...
Only if they want to write a Guy Gavriel K book, then that's how they do it.
Who knows? But I do believe what you just said reminded me of something, a conversation I just had. Because I don't know where the books are going, because I don't know exactly what's going to happen next, and for me, they represent a discovery process. And sometimes a very anxiety-provoking one, a nervous-making one, because you get up every morning and you're not quite sure what's happening next. You've got to be smart that day. You have to figure something out to keep it moving. That sense of surfing a wave that may be a little bigger than you can actually handle.
Mm-hmm.
I've always believed that on some subconscious level, my readers are aware that I'm on that discovery process too as I write the book. And what you're talking about, that sense of finding what happens next, is enhanced by the writer being on the same journey. Then craft comes in later, and you rewrite and you rewrite and you polish, and I'm doing endless revisions. But the story I'm discovering as I do it. And I think for the reader, some of that might come through under the text.
Yeah, it certainly does for me. How about the part that you can't just visit? You can't just visit Celtic religion or whatever. And the...
research?
Yeah.
Imaginative empathy? An enormous amount of the creative process is an exercise in imagining yourself out of your own head.
Mm-hmm.
Into someone else's, into sometimes a long way removed from your own. We began this conversation talking about readers' responses to a teenage protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember I said to you that in a lot of ways, for me, that was far less a leap of imagination than many of the characters I've had to create over the last 20 years who are very far removed from my own world and my own worldview. I mean, I was not so damn long ago a teenage male once.
Yes, but you see, here I would argue that, you know, I am sitting here, I have my gadgets and toys, I'm carrying my phone with the camera built in, my little PDA and a spiffy new recorder, but it would never have occurred to me to go and swap around people's ringtones.
You're a good human being.
Well, yes, thank you. But the point is that I think there are teenagers to whom this might not. People who have grown up with the concept of a ringtone and all that, to whom this might not have occurred. So this is more than, you know, when you
create a Byzantine emperor. It's the act of imagination, even within a contemporary normal context.
Yes.
I hear you.
Even harder than, say, creating a Byzantine emperor, because there's a certain point at which somebody will say, well, who's going to challenge him? He made
That's
such
exactly
a incredible
right.
character.
We're all capable of challenging. Let me give you let me give you an extension of that point. When I was younger, And readers would come up to me, or reviewers would comment on how well done my female characters were.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was younger, I would pat myself on the back for that. I would feel extremely pleased. I pulled it off, sort of thing.
Something Charles Dickens never quite did.
Well, right. But then I realized
doesn't
mean
great
that a lot
novelists
of the women
couldn't do that.
Yeah, Tolkien too.
He got away with it by simply not putting in any female characters. Dickens did, and he was abysmal at it.
But here's what's going on. When somebody says the female characters are very good, what's going on as a subtext of that is, and it amazes me, that a Y chromosome carrier could possibly have the intellectual and emotive capacity to get in the ballpark of dealing with a woman. You know, I'm being flippant about it, but what's going on for me is this. If I can't create a female character, I can't create a geriatric. I can't create someone who has lost their family in a fire. I can't create an emperor or a slave. We are left with writing nothing but autobiographies.
Mm-hmm.
So what it really comes down to, and you taught, I said writing and you said good writing, it really comes down to is that good writing is going to involve the ability and the effort to try to be convincing with characters who are nothing close to yourself. I think it was Goethe who said, there's no act I can imagine that I can't imagine myself creating.
Mm-hmm.
He made it very personal. There's a lot of acts I can imagine that I can't imagine myself doing.
Yeah.
But I can imagine somebody I've created doing those.
Yeah. And that's a key thing, because on the one hand, in Isabel, you have Ned Mariner, the young contemporary person who is looking down the end of a very long tunnel through history,
right,
to a couple of different places. And the interesting thing is we as the readers, through Ned's eyes, we can also see down that tunnel, and we can see there's a whole other world there that is as fully imagined as the place in which Isabel is currently taking place.
Oh, now we're getting into something. We go another hour or two on that as well, which every book I've ever written, I've wanted to convey to some degree the idea that you're reading this story,
mm-hmm,
but I could be telling a different one.
That's right.
If you shift the optics just a little bit, most of all my books, this shows up in Last Light of the Sun, where mm-hmm, there are many sort of marginal lives of people who come in carrying a message. And in the novel, I run through their entire life in 3 pages
mm-hmm
of the messenger. And I did this because, in fact, the Icelandic sagas do this. I was taking my cue from my research. But it dovetailed so perfectly with a feeling I have that just because the book ends, it doesn't mean that the lives should be deemed to end.
There are all these Rosencrantzes and Guildensterns.
You've got it. You've got it. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that we can be following. We could go for another hour and three more, but we are closing out on time. So what is next?
What I'm doing right now is I'm entangled with Hollywood. I've got 2 books under development.
Actually, development. These aren't just options.
Warner Brothers have optioned and are developing Lions of Alwasan for Ed Zwick, the director attached to the project.
Mm-hmm.
The lead producer is Kathy Schulman, who produced Crash,
right,
which she's best known for, and The Illusionist this past year.
Very good film.
The other one is
not fully successful, but really great attempt.
And good
really
people.
Good people and well worth seeing,
mm-hmm, yeah,
even though I would say that if they wanted to remake it today, they might do it just a little different.
You know, we're back to there, and you can make everything a little different.
Yeah.
So that one is being developed by Warners. The other project, which is a year younger, is Robert Chartoff, who did Raging Bull and all the Rocky movies,
mm-hmm,
is developing with a partner named Ted Robinette Last Light of the Sun.
Hmm.
That partnership are the team who are working on Scott Card's Ender's Game.
Right.
So their next project, that's been taking them a long time for a variety of reasons, usually having to do with script. On the Last Light of the Sun project, they've done a really reckless thing, and they've asked the novelist to adapt the book for screenplay. Ah. And the novelist did an even more reckless thing, and I said yes.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a whole new oeuvre, if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
That's going to be the spring, certainly. Depending on what happens next, it could be more than the spring. I've been told by my agent in Los Angeles, who keeps reminding me that Saving Private Ryan had 29 drafts.
That's right.
That's the way that industry works. So I may disappear down a bottomless hole. In fact, I say that flippantly because I won't.
Yeah.
I won't. I will run with this to a certain point, give it everything I can to try to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't seem to be satisfying the needs of Hollywood, along with my own needs for an adaptation of my book, then we will part company cordially, and I'll move on to whatever the next novel turns out to be.
Right.
But for the immediate future, that's what I'm doing.
Okay. Well, with that, all I can do is thank you so much, and beg that next time you come through here, we can do this again, and perhaps at even more length.
I'll be happy to sit down with you again, Jim. I enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you.
No. It's not time for Steel Eye quite yet. Give it 3 or 4 minutes and we'll do it. But I've been having a conversation here and sort of lost track of what was going on. But I can tell you that you were listening to an interview with fantasy writer Guy Gavriel Kaye, whose novel Isabel had just come out about then. Yeah. Let me see. Has he done? I have to look at his bibliography to see how many books he has had since then. Yes, a book called Under Seven, a story based on the 8th century Deng Dynasty. River of Stars, coming out still this year. So, those are actually. The first is a story, the second is a novel, and that's what you have to look forward to. But if you want to look him up, his name, G-U-Y, Guy, as in A, he's a guy, Gavriel, G-A-V-R-I-E-L, K-A-Y, Guy Gavriel K, and all I can tell you is he is well, well worth reading. And I hope that you have enjoyed it. Okay, next week we're going to have another anniversary program. I mean, it's not necessarily that we are celebrating the anniversary per se. It is simply that we are noting it, that I am mentioning it. Although you never know what could happen. We might, you know, bring somebody in. Okay, so. Any announcements that I have this week? No, there's no readings coming up this week. There was one tonight that I missed, but Gordon Linsner has been recording it. Ever since KGB is on Wednesday nights, and ever since the 2 years now, 2.5 years that this program has been on Wednesday nights, it is very difficult for me to get to the KGB readings, but they are being recorded for me, and hopefully we will broadcast those in the future. So, let's see, there's no readings next week. Our next reading for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, which I produce, will be February 5th with Paul Witkover and Sarah McCary. Okay, let's see. Good morning. You've got about 1 minute before I have to go off the air.
Good morning. I would love to see The Lions of Albazan done as a film.
Yeah, that would be an interesting thing, wouldn't it?
The reason is, I do not know, with the possible exception of the Charlton Heston El Cid, of any films that have been done, with the in that period of Spanish history. And one reason that I love Hay's work is that he deals with borderlands, crossroad cultures, whether it's Provence with the Celts, 12th century Spain with the La Reconquista, with the Moors, the Jews, the Christians. And all of his books are cultural clashes on a big level and on a small level. And boy, would I love to see Lyons done as a movie.
That would be real interesting. All it needs is somebody who would really make it.
yeah. And it would probably be...
That's always the problem.
It'll be, and I'll bet it would be a big budget film.
Yeah, yeah.
$200 million at least.
Oh, a one-person film is $200 million today, with the exception of Beast of the Southern Wild. Anyhow, I do. As mentioned, I have to go off.
Bye.
Take care. Bye bye. Let's see. If you care to join me online, there are a few ways of doing that. One is visit ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. The other is to go to Facebook. And you will find an Hour of the Wolf group there. There's actually two. One refers to the movie by Ingmar Bergman, and the other one refers to this radio show. And it's an open public group. I don't know why people seem to have to request to join it, but I will just automatically approve people. There's no problem with that. Also, the reading series I produced, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, is also a Facebook group, and you can do that. You can also follow me on Twitter, which is at Jim Freund, J-I-M-F-R-E-U-N-D, and just look that up on Twitter, and there you shall find. So, again, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming these ways in these, the end days of WBAI's existence at 120 Wall Street, as we prepare to move on uptown, for better and or worse. In the meantime, try to stay healthy. It's dangerous out there. Drink lots of soup, stay warm, and be good to people. Good morning.
live, now I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. Wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Just a mother in it. You gave me freedom of speech and the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the suit. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
FM WBAI, Burn Baby Burn. We do this until 5 o'clock right here at 99 Cinco List Alive. Exactly 7 minutes after 3 o'clock, Michael Rose, y'all.
Darkness.
Uh-huh. Yes, I
seems to go by the world.
Love this, ya tune, y'all. Robert Knight, welcome back home, y'all. Missed you. Didn't know you had surgery. But I love you live right here at 99 Cinco. 5 o'clock shadow this afternoon, don't miss it. Robert Knight is back. Where he belongs. Misses his mummy.
Yes, my strength.
I miss her too. Michael Rose.
Among the rioters, eaters of flesh. There is no return to your faulty destruction. My blood is hot. You're telling I. Darkness seems to go. Darkness
is speaking. Now what good does it do a man to fight against his own cousin, let alone his brothers and sisters? There is no gain, you fight against yourself. A flu.
Yeah. Police and thief in a shootout. Police and thief in a shootout.
Only a fool would spill his own blood.
Get them belly full.
I said, oh, good God of grace, please don't let them pass my way. When they're out there on their chases, just pray you're not around. Innocent are dead from station, so pray you're not around. Better you try face immigration and pray you're not around. With only one life to live, better try run for the hills. For now, for school, it be wages to feed them hungry mouths. It's only one bloody oasis. I run in a joke. So much chance of murder cases. There's no end to the doubt. Disappear without a trace. Just a name without a face. La, la, la.
Police and thief couldn't be friends. Yet the two of them are road set the same trend. Put the money on them head and them ears. Them what if we not real them? Them born and shape out in a badness. Them treat life like a sadness. If them not go and jail, them got a casket.
Uh-huh.
Them show